This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry from Guardian Australia. Well, the wash-up from the South Australian election 1 week on, first of all, I guess, to the winners for Labor. One of their best results across the country anywhere. One Nation, all attention was on One Nation, and from nowhere to a primary vote of 22%, but few seats to show for it. And for the Liberals, well, they started out at a historically low base of 13 seats and they lost half of them, Tony. What about the Liberal Party as a result of this? Are they a dead parrot or are they just resting?
Yeah, clean up on aisle 19% for the Liberal Party. A result of sub 20% is unrecorded in Liberal Party modern history. And for context, they need to really be at 45% primary vote to win. So arguably they could do it in the high 30s with a great preference flow. Very unlikely. So 19% is miles off the pace. But one of the other storylines, which I thought was really interesting, apart from the hammer coming down on the Liberal Party, was in those safe Labor seats, like Elizabeth, Giles, Mawson, the Labor Party had swings against it, as did the Liberal candidate, off a very low base. But One Nation recorded swings to it of over 20%. And so a lot of that was at the expense of the Labor candidate. Now, it's sometimes hard where when expectations are so high and where effectively Saturday was a coronation, not an election, where voters are more inclined to give the incumbent government a whack in those safe Labor seats where they know it's consequence-free. But the fact that Malinauskas on the Friday before the election, his closing messages were about One Nation, and the fact that then again on Saturday night with that brilliant acceptance speech of his, he went One Nation again, tells me that their polling was telling them that they were in strife with some of those Labor soft voters who were handsome curious.
Yeah, and I think Anthony Albanese has shown signs of that as well, that he will adopt a similar strategy. So Labor lost some support in those safe seats, but they didn't lose any seats, not yet anyway, to One Nation. But they did gain seats from the Liberal Party, so the Liberal Party went backwards.
Yeah, well, not only did the Liberal Party go backwards, and they're probably going to land on Anthony Green's latest calculations, probably five seats, and One Nation might land on four.
What if One Nation was to get to five? Just hypothetically, and the coalition's on five and say there are three or four independents. What happens then? Who's the official opposition?
Yeah, well, on top of that, it looks like One Nation will pick up three upper house seats. The Liberal Party only picked up two. So they're going to be fairly comparable in terms of representation in both houses. The other storyline, which was really interesting to me, is that Bragg is the only urban seat in Adelaide now for the Liberal Party. So that's in the southern part of Sturt, Christopher Pine's old seat. That was his sort of power base, very wealthy area. And now they don't have any real estate in all of metropolitan Adelaide, which is a pattern we've seen in other elections in recent times. Federally, the Liberal Party only has 9 out of 88 urban seats as defined by the AEC. And even in Queensland, where Chris Afuli, who's a great political product, he won 17 seats, but 15 of those were in the regions, towns like Mackay and Rockhampton, were won by the Liberal Party for the first time since Federation. They only picked up 2 seats in metropolitan Brisbane. So to me, this speaks to that disconnect that the Liberal Party has with metropolitan seats. And that's a consequence, I think, of being National Party light.
Yeah, and it looks as if, and we need to really evaluate it when all of the figures are in, but it does seem as if One Nation, of course they outpolled the Liberal Party in the rural areas, but it looks as if they might have outpolled them in the city as well.
Yeah.
And that's something. But what I'm really interested in is also looking at just how much federal strategists and the major parties can take from all of this. Because we went in, first of all, we wanted to see whether the polling stood up, whether the polling is just a protest and doesn't hold up at elections. It did, because most polls have predicted 20 to 22% primary vote for One Nation, and they got it. On the other hand, though, that did not necessarily translate to seats. It might translate to three or four in the end, who knows, but not a lot. But we also know that the South Australian situation is not typical and won't be typical. It won't be replicated anywhere else because of the very strong Labor vote. And the Labor vote is stronger in South Australia than anywhere else. So you can't just say, well, this happened in South Australia, therefore this is what's going to happen in Victoria. Because the Labor vote in South Australia is about 37.7%. At an election, at the latest poll in Victoria, it's 27. So as a result of that much weaker Labor vote, you're going to get different results. One Nation will do better, better than they did in South Australia with the vote that they get.
Yeah. I mean, every election is different. I know voters think they're all the same, but they're actually all very different in terms of the leaders, their personalities, their track record, their vision for the future, but also the longevity of the government. So in Victoria, we have a 12-year-old government asking for 16. That's always incredibly difficult. For context, the Brax-Brumby government was objectively a pretty good government. They only got 11. The New South Wales government, Liberal government, that lost 3 years ago, they only got 12 years, and they're objectively a pretty good government. So every election will be different, but I think one of the other lessons out of South Australia was One Nation sitting on one seat definite could land on four. That is a danger for the Liberal Party because in voters' minds who might have previously thought it's just a protest vote and I don't want to so-called waste my vote, they might look at that and go, oh, actually, so we can get MPs elected to be a voice for me and my grievance. And that could be the last mental break for a lot of Liberal voters, soft Liberal voters, who were tempted to vote Hanson, who then subsequently vote at subsequent elections.
Now, the preferences are going to be critical to this when we get to the Farabee election and then when we get to the Victorian election. There is, seems to me, three strategies open to the Liberal Party or the Liberal National Party, depending on where you are and what you're talking about. In South Australia, I think the Liberals got the worst outcome, actually, by giving One Nation their preferences and getting nothing back in return. That's the first approach. Because I think you lose some of your primary vote simply by seeming to flirt with a party that some Liberal voters can't abide. So you lose some of your primary vote even if you pick up some number of preferences that you wouldn't have otherwise got, right? That's my view on taking that strategy. The second one is now the Geoff Kennett approach in Victoria, and that is you do a preference swap. And you would, again, get some advantage from the preference swap, but I do think you'll lose some of the primary vote if you're to go down that path. And the third, and it never seems to be discussed, it just doesn't seem to be on the table, and that is no deal. No deal's an open ticket. The Liberal leader was asked about it on commercial radio in Melbourne, and she said this is a matter for the party machine, not for her. I think that's I've heard that from all parties. They all say that. But in reality, there wouldn't be many political leaders that would leave a decision like that entirely to the to whoever's running the campaign.
I think the rise of One Nation has been so sudden and so ferocious, and the fact that it is also starting to eat into Labor territory a little bit. The seat of light in South Australia became a One Nation Labor contest, and it looks like Labor will win that, but not by a lot. That has a lot of party spooked at the moment because they don't know how to deal with it, and they'll be undoubtedly in the field doing research. But we come back to the point we've made earlier, which is you just need to take them head on and drive down their primary vote and win back primary vote, because the Liberal Party is not going to win Farah with a primary vote around 20%.
What would you be advising the Liberal Party on preferences at the Victorian election? Because it just seems to me that the no-deal open ticket is probably because you've got the two confronting considerations, and I just think that is the cleanest way to go in terms of the dividend you'll get.
At the moment, they effectively don't have any policies apart from immigration. The danger for the Liberal Party in doing any sort of deal is that any subsequent policies that Hanson or One Nation announce, which is totally unacceptable or crazy, you own. And then you have to effectively defend that policy in front of the media as to why you're preferencing them. And that can be an exaggeration, of course, because if you're preferencing Greens first, they've got some policies as well that people find conflicts with their personal values. But it's going to be a very difficult issue for the coalition to navigate And that's which is why they just need to offer something more positive to the electorate, try and win some of that vote back. Victoria's going to be slightly different because it's going to be effectively a referendum against Jacinta Allen as Premier and her performance. And we know that her numbers are catastrophic.
And just for the record, the numbers, the latest numbers in Victoria in the poll published in the Herald Sun has the Liberal National Party now leading on primary vote at 30, with Labor at 27 and One Nation at 20. That surprises me. The One Nation is not that far from the vote that it got in South Australia. The Greens on 14. That would translate to a 52-48 victory for the LNP, two-party preferred, if it was to come to that. But, of course, there's a long way to go between now and then. It's interesting you mentioned the seat of light too, because I think there are parallels between the nature of that seat and the sort of seats that Labor will need to defend in Victoria and in the federal election. There are seats like that, and it does demonstrate that Labor has to have one eye to some of those seats. They haven't got that. Look, the earthquake that's going on is going on the Conservative side of politics.
Yeah.
No doubt about that. Yeah. That's where it is. But there are small tremors.
Yeah.
There are small tremors in some Labor seats, and they'll need to keep an eye on that.
Yeah. And the likes of Malinauskas and Chris Minns in New South Wales are smart enough to realise that, which is why they're already onto that job of demolishing the case for One Nation and effectively ring-fencing their own vote.
Now, let's talk about the budget, because there are great unknowns. There's always this talk of reform, but it depends on what you mean by reform, of course, because I just notice in some of the financial newspapers in this country, they call for reform, and then when ideas are put forward, they don't like them, because basically the sort of reform that a lot of them like is something that increases business profits and not much else. And so things like the capital gains tax, negative gearing, super profits tax and the rest of them don't seem to appeal them so much. I don't know what it is that they basically want. But it just seems to me now that what we're looking at is a set of circumstances that suit the government if they're that way inclined. If they really want to now start doing things that some of it people won't like, others on the other side, if they are going to move on some new taxes or increasing taxes on corporations and businesses, this is the time to do it.
Yeah, I think Albanese needs to be very careful that they not just seem to be a higher taxing government. Obviously, introducing more taxes is not the solution to everything. If it were, the state of Victoria would be one of the strongest states in Australia instead of one of the weakest. There is, I think, the preconditions existing for reform around capital gains tax, as well as the gas export levy proposal. Other third parties have been out there preparing the soil for this change, which is exactly what you want as a government. You need stakeholders to be out there providing air cover so you can then go in and do the change. It's very difficult as a government to be the only one out there calling on any sort of reform or change when no one else is behind you in the trenches. And a business does have a habit of calling for change, but then not putting their money where their mouth is and then campaigning for that and helping to prepare the electorate for why it is important reform. I think with CGT, there's going to be a bit of a booby trap for the coalition. There is such a protest movement underway, as manifested by the One Nation vote, and as we discussed previously, 21% of that on our polling, of those who are voting One Nation, are saying it's because of the two-party system. They're just fed up with two-party politics. And what they perceive is not a lot of change between the major parties in their perception. So for them, if the coalition just opposes these taxes or proposals for the sake of opposing it, that will drive them further away from both major parties and drive them into the arms of One Nation. The trick for the coalition will be to be seen to be proactive and being constructive.
Or, rather than just be seen to be, why not just be proactive?
Well, I think the opportunity here is to say on something like capital gains tax, is to sort of say we support it. I mean, they've got no choice because Labor and the Greens in the Senate have got the numbers. To say we support this, but we would amend it to be offset by income tax cuts, which is the best way to help Gen Z and millennials save for the future and invest in housing and so forth. And you could do the same with a levy or a tax on gas exports. And that's the that will be seen to be constructive, and it'll also be difficult for the Labor Party because they'll have the decision to make as well.
Yeah, and when you make the point about the level of support that governments need in order to make these changes, right, there needs to be some sort of support there. That wasn't true of John Howard with the GST. He just went with it anyway and persuaded people to do it. Keating did it on the economy. Hawke did it on immigration.
Yeah.
And that was always a hard sell, but he did it. I think, though, Albanese is less inclined to do that, and the experience of the voice, of course, would still burn. So to what extent is Andrew Hastie's position now on that declared in an interview with The Guardian, he would support taxes on some of the cash companies, an increase in the taxes. That's quite a political play on his part, and I think it's more than just a political play. And that would give the Labor Party some encouragement, wouldn't it, if they're looking at increasing these taxes?
Yeah, and it goes to that unorthodoxy of Andrew Hastie and why I think he's a dangerous opponent for Albanese eventually. I still feel this is going to be a three-leader term federally for the opposition. And he represents an unpredictable force who comes out with things that might be seen as populist, and therefore makes him a harder opponent for someone like Albanese, who's at the peak of his powers right now, to confront.
And I can understand why he's taking this position. Rod Sims, who's a former chair of the ACCC and he's now chair of the Superpower Institute, wrote a column in The Guardian, and he talked about that Australian gas belongs to all of us, right? The benefits should be shared rather than hoarded by companies that pay some of the lowest taxes in the world. So he's talking about imposing an extra levy, not in response to the Iran crisis, not a temporary thing, but a permanent arrangement. And he wrote about the same as Norway, similar to the UK, some major fossil fuels in other countries. He takes the view that the fossil fuels belong to the country, so you share it with those who are prepared to do the work and those who own the fossil fuels. And the share can be between 75 and 90% in some places. The Australian share at the moment is 27%. He said the share should be 50-50. And even that would be still at the lower end of world standards. But the point about all of this, it would make a massive difference. We're talking $20 billion that would then be available to the government over time to go to work on cost of living initiatives. Now, Redbridge, your polling company, ran a survey for Superpower, and the survey showed support at 87% for this kind of action. They feel that the country deserves a better share. Only 3% disagree. And I suppose when you're asking them, do you, and a lot of these are, most of them are foreign companies. So if you want the foreign companies to be taxed more as they export our products, then yeah, you're only going to get 3% disagreeing with that proposition.
Yeah, we put that poll in the field late last year and it's been publicly reported. One of the shortcomings of those sort of questions, which is why you do accompanying focus groups, is to give deeper meaning to it, and where people can discuss it, and then they might come up with concerns and hesitations. Obviously, in some states like WA and Queensland, which has a big commodities market and sector, there then becomes a few hesitations about what it might mean for future investment. And that is one thing that question doesn't really go to. But there is overwhelming support for a rearrangement of the existing regime. Obviously, it's very complicated because a lot of these companies overseas have invested heavily in the infrastructure. It's one thing to own their gas in Australia, but you need to get it to market.
Yeah.
And they have made those investments in terms of infrastructure. They've employed a lot of people to build the infrastructure, and then obviously a much smaller employment sector now to maintain the infrastructure. But these investments, there's dimensions around sovereign risk and so forth. So it's not, you know, I know that some advocates for this change argue that, you know, there's almost like a Labor and Liberal conspiracy to not tax these markets in the past. It's the one thing they do agree on. But part of that is because they recognise that, you know, business craves stability and certainty. So changing the taxation regimes, it comes with risk. And Albanese is going to have to weigh up the risk versus the reward, as all political decisions are.
They won't stop exporting. If you raise the tax to 50%, I wouldn't think, when still money to be made.
I think there's a tremendous opportunity for the government to do that change, because there is now sufficient air cover with people like Rod Sims coming out and advocating for it, voters are persuaded by these things. So whereas maybe 10 years ago they would have thought, well, why are we doing this? There is now a bit more understanding around it. People have picked it up. They've heard it on radio a bit and read about it online. And so the preconditions are probably there for some change.
We'll pick up on some of the tactics that are being employed now around the energy debate as a result of the Iran-US-Israel war. But we'll take a break. Be back in a moment.